Hey everyone, welcome back to the Dealing with Lifestyle podcast. My name is Fernando.
I'm Randy.
And this is the podcast.
Yep.
So what's up, Matt? What are we talking about today?
Matt, we're talking about minimum wage, a less contentious topic than some of the other ones in our current zeitgeist, but one that I think is worth discussing since there's, you know, proposals to increase the minimum wage nationally to $15 an hour, which I think is outrageous, but that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about why and, you know, what is minimum wage? Is it a good thing? Should we have a minimum wage? And I can say from my, I come from a perspective of where I used to be a big advocate for a minimum wage back when I had more socialist views, but now I just having studied it more, and especially through Thomas Sowell, who's my, I'd say, political philosophy mentor.
He's a hero.
Yeah, that too. I mean, I do have a Thomas Sowell shirt, but he has been a big factor for me understanding how the dangers of minimum wage to that there are, to me, more dangers to minimum wage than there are upsides and more costs to minimum wage than people may typically think about.
I feel like sometimes when we have this conversation, sometimes people feel like minimum wage and living wage are the same thing, but they're not, right?
Correct.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, we can reference like Thomas Sowell book here. This is Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell, 5th edition. Hold on, I think I even marked a page about living wage. Ah, here we go. So I'm just going to read this paragraph, and I'll get your take on it, Fernando. It says, among 3.6 million earning no more than the minimum wage in 2012, just over half were from 16 to 24 years of age, and 64% of them worked part-time. Yet political campaigns to increase the minimum wage often talk in terms of providing, quote, a living wage, end quote, sufficient to support a family of four. Such families as most minimum wage workers do not have and would be ill-advised to have before they reach the point where they could feed and clothe their children. The average family income of a minimum wage worker is more than $44,000 a year, far more than can be earned by someone working at minimum wages. But 42% of minimum wage workers live with parents or some other relative. In other words, they are not supporting a family, but often a family is supporting them. Only 15% of minimum wage workers are supporting themselves and a dependent, the kind of person envisioned by those who advocate a living wage.
So 15% are the ones who take care of an actual family.
Correct.
And so what about the rest of the 35%? This is a combination of people who either have a family or don't have a family, or live at home or don't live at home.
Right.
And but we can establish that 50% of people who work a minimum wage job are between the ages of 15 and 24.
It's
or 52%.
Yeah, 16 to 24.
Yeah. 16 to 24.
Yeah. Yeah. But we should start even higher scale. We should even discuss what is a minimum wage.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to go back to that, but I wanted to make sure at least we established that they're two different things, right?
Yes.
So what is minimum wage in your eyes?
Well, minimum wage is a government-enforced wage that all workers must be paid with that's just the absolute minimum anybody can be paid. It's forced legislation in that essence.
And I guess in your perspective, do you think that's wrong that we do have a minimum wage at all?
Well, let me take this from two perspectives. One, I think it's immoral that anyone should have the authority to tell you what to do in regards to your business, because it seems like they're approaching it from an arbitrary moral standpoint that may or may not be based in reality. So I have issues with that because it could lead to consequences down the road when who is the authority getting to establish that and enforce that policy. It sets a precedent.
Gotcha.
The other factor is the minimum wage law, or the lowest minimum wage, regardless of any laws in place, is $0. And all the I'd say 90% of the empirical evidence in place shows that the further you increase the minimum wage, the higher unemployment goes.
Yeah, I think I read a figure or something along the lines of 1.4 million people would lose a job if you increase minimum wage to $15.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, you would be helping millions of people, but at the same time, you'd be eliminating jobs at the same time. So it's more of a balancing act as to who are you helping really, and mm-hmm. who are you going to damage, and what is the long-term effect of doing those damages.
Yep.
So I believe 50% of the businesses we have in America are small businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were to just turn the switch and say, hey, everybody has to pay $15 an hour,
mm-hmm.
a lot of businesses would go out of business.
Right.
So I think it's, you know, I don't have enough information to advocate for a minimum wage increase. Mm-hmm. But I do want to advocate for the people who can't speak for themselves as far as a living wage, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like, I want to advocate for the whole minimum wage thing, but it's a difficult conversation to have right now because we are talking about minimum wage, because mm-hmm. living wage is a whole completely different conversation.
Right. Because and you have to take in family components. Right.
And I think there's other legislation that can help those people have a living wage without having to increase the minimum wage. What? As in, like, there's other, and again, I haven't thought this thoughts through.
That's so okay.
It's kind of, I'm just kind of coming out of the, shooting the hip from here.
This is a discussion.
I feel like there's other potential policies that can be implemented through other government programs to help fill the gap between being able to work a minimum wage job and actually have a living wage.
Okay, I'd be interested to hear what kind of policy you're thinking about.
Well, maybe not policy, but programs, okay. Right? So like the things I talk about are, and we're going to talk about this in the future, but food stamps and housing and government assistance for, you know, being able to subsidize lunches for your family, whatever mm-hmm. the case is. So to me, there's a long list of programs that are already out there that can better be utilized and executed for the people who need this type of help. Mm. But I don't know necessarily that minimum wage or increasing the minimum wage is going to fix the 35% of the people or 15% of the people that I'm advocating for. Because I don't necessarily think that kids from between the ages of 16 and 24 have to have a bunch of disposable income. They just need to have a job. I know there's a discussion that needs to be had about increasing minimum wage with inflation. But if that were the case, I think we'd be at a point of $24 an hour, which, I mean, doesn't really make a lot of sense. But anyways, I'll pause it there.
Yeah, well, I have an interesting idea that I had a discussion about last night. My buddy talked about how we could help those types of folks with that more or less living wage or giving them the ability to work. Because ultimately, some people are not worth the minimum wage amount. It's like, if I'm being forced to pay someone $24 an hour and they're not worth $24 an hour, I'm not going to pay them. I'm not going to hire them. So that's tough because it there is a skill set that you can build upon even without education if you enter into a, let's say, a dollar an hour job. Like,
but even that statement, I mean, you're going from it from an economics standpoint, right? Because I think sometimes with statements like that, people can view it as, well, Randy or someone doesn't value the life of a person because they're not worth a certain thing. It's more about, like, you know, removing the person aside. Mm-hmm. This individual, or it's kind of hard to use certain words that don't bring it back to a person. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's someone is doing these tasks, right?
Right.
And is that kind of the approach that you're bringing from it? Because it's kind of hard to, like, hear that a person isn't worth. So, like, I don't know.
A person's productivity is not worth a certain dollar per hour. Yes.
I think for, like, those statements lead to more constructive, like, conversation for the general public. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Sure. It's from the... Oh, that's a great point. So Travis is in here, too. He's just hanging out listening.
He's tag teaming in.
He's chiming in here bits here. He just passed a note that's really interesting. He said, special needs struggle... What was it? Yeah, special needs struggle finding jobs because of minimum wage, which is really interesting. Yeah. And, you know, my mom worked with a lot of special needs kids, and Goodwill is a great company that does hire them and gives them an opportunity, but it's absolutely right that someone who is, like, mentally retarded, that doesn't have the necessary capacity to, let's say, be a CEO of a company, where do they fit in society? Mm-hmm. If we can't afford to pay them $20 an hour, what happens then? So you talked about...
I was just getting at, like, you know, when we say things like, this person isn't worth a certain thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people come in and they bring the emotional aspect and say, well, who are you to say that someone isn't worth something? Like, you don't know their struggles. You don't know their problems. You don't know their X, Y, Z.
Sure.
And I think that's where things start getting a little bit heated between people. Because, like, well, like, my mom or my this or my that, it's like, they bring the emotional aspect to it. And I think it's important when we have these economic conversations that we have to remove the emotions aside a little bit to be able to have a conversation about business and numbers, because numbers speak for themselves.
Right. So let's lay out where we agree. You would probably agree with this, but we both want the best possible amount of good for the most amount of people.
100%.
Fair enough. So where I'll stand and where I'll make a case here is, increasing minimum wage reduces the number of, or increases unemployment.
I don't know for a fact, but based on what I've read, that's the case.
I have
the numbers, yeah.
Yeah. So minimum wage increases unemployment. That means there are less people able to feed themselves and those who may or may not depend on
you make
on
more
them.
Damage.
Correct. So therefore, minimum wage causes more damage to more people than not having minimum wage.
Which is almost ironic for the people who are trying to push, let's help more people.
Yeah. Yeah. Travis has another note here. What is more fulfilling for special needs, living on government funds or having a productive job? That's a great question.
Yeah. And I don't have enough special needs in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that sounds right.
You have your own special needs.
Yeah, I do. But to be able to, I guess, to come up with a perspective,
mm-hmm.
I would imagine that the person, regardless of their needs or not, mm-hmm. wants to feel like the fulfillment mm-hmm. and purpose.
Yes. Wholeheartedly agree.
Because nobody wants to feel like they're just a leech.
Right.
And help again.
So in that instance, do you feel that people who, let's say they do demand a higher minimum wage, even if they lack the productive skills capable to add value at that particular rate, do you feel that they are going to find purpose even though they would go into a job?
No, I mean, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, it sucks because, like, the minimum wage conversation
mm-hmm.
to me is almost like an umbrella to a lot of problems underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
Because depending on who you're listening to, they bring up certain issues.
Mm-hmm.
So some people will say, well, what about the 15% of people who can't even have a living wage for their two kids
mm-hmm.
and their divorce, whatever the case is?
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem.
It is a
but
problem.
But it's not a problem that's going to get fixed by minimum wage.
Right.
Well, what about the people who are exploiting
mm-hmm.
their employees, whether that be a big corporation? That's a different problem.
Sure. Well, so let's talk about exploitation too. And first I want to say that it sucks for that 15%.
Yeah, it does.
It does. It's also a choice to have those kids and that family when you don't have the income to support it.
Yeah.
And
we know the circumstances, but yes, at the end of the day, it's their choice.
Absolutely. It is. Yeah. There are consequences to actions. And so exploitation, if there is no minimum wage, would you agree it's easier to go through different jobs or try out different jobs because there's more labor capital in essence. Yeah. So if you are in an instance of being exploited by your boss, wouldn't you, in theory, be able to jump to another company more easily without a minimum
depends
wage?
Depends on the person, I think.
Mm.
I think depends on the person because some people feel like if I don't have this job, I have nothing.
Mm.
And they just have to go through it. I mean, like my mom was a great example. Like she's been exploited by, you know, employees
mm-hmm.
or employers in the past.
Sure.
And she had no other option. Like it's either this or I don't pay the bills and I keep digging a deeper hole.
Mm-hmm.
So I have empathy for that. But at the end of the day, like, she doesn't have a certain skill set that allows her to be more desired for mm-hmm. other companies at the end of the day. And so, like, again, if we talk about choice, like, that was her choice.
Mm-hmm.
Circumstances dictate that she almost didn't have a choice, but, I mean, at the end of the day, she does.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more philosophy, right, for mm-hmm. us to talk about that. But where's it going with this? To me, you know, the whole exploitation thing, you can't fix an exploitation problem with employers
mm-hmm.
with just trying to fix a minimum wage problem.
Because
to me, like, you're bringing in more baggage when you try to fix that problem with minimum wage.
So I want to make sure I understand. When you say exploitation, what are we defining here?
I don't want to say company names, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like, there's big corporations that they just pay the minimum wage for their employees.
Mm-hmm.
And like they're making a shit ton of money. And again, I don't have enough information to be able to have an eloquent statement.
Mm-hmm.
But from my understanding, from what I've read and what I've, I guess, listen to, is these companies just, they're exploiting their employees by paying them the minimum that they can possibly give
mm-hmm.
when the business makes sense to give them more because they'd be more productive, whatever the case is.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure there's, you know, they talked about that there.
There is. To some degree. Here's a question I have for you though. Do you think that most people who get paid a minimum wage get paid a minimum wage throughout most of their life? Or do you think that getting paid a minimum wage helps them develop a skill set to where they can make more money down the road?
I mean, based on the percentages that we've heard, right, in the mm-hmm. books, that's 48% of the people. 48% of the people live a minimum wage for their whole life.
No, that is not what that says. It's saying that...
Well, maybe not for their whole life, but 48% of the people are people who are the ages of 24 and above.
Yes, but it is saying that, so the 16 to 24 year old, that 52% or whatever, that is working minimum wage, 64% of that is even part-time. Minimum wage is not meant to be a wage you maintain.
It's not supposed to be, but...
Right, and it's generally not. Let's see, I'm gonna find this point in here because it's very interesting. Travis, fill the gap here while I look this up.
But, I mean, I do know people who work minimum wage their whole life.
Well, and like, I don't know. I find it interesting that these, say, large corporations that people tend to like to throw out, say they're paying minimum wage, when you look at, say, Amazon, that's paying greater than it, and they're advocating. You see now these larger corporations advocating for paying higher wages. And I think it fits well into, I guess, the current kind of culture war going on. But when I look at it, I tend to perceive it as, okay, these big corporations have made this great success, and now they're really kind of wanting to crush these small businesses even more since they can't support that wage. These big corporations are financially motivated to have a higher minimum wage.
Oh, that's what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, like, these higher corporations, if they do bring in a higher minimum wage, all that's going to do is mess up the small businesses and in turn help them out?
Well, like as we go into these higher pay scales, say the popular $15 an hour, you're seeing these big corporations pay that, if not more now, and advocating for that legislation to come into place. But do you see really a tremendous amount of small business owners advocating for the same? At least no. What I'm seeing is the small business owners are the ones that are saying, hey, no, this would be detrimental to my
business.
It would be, yeah. But because of these, say, large balance sheet corporations, they can afford it now given the size that they're at. And wouldn't you as a, say, big corporation want to squash competition?
That's what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. But I think the two companies that come to mind is Amazon and Walmart. Mm-hmm. I think those are the ones that were being pushed politically the hardest.
Yep.
And they were forced to bring those, I guess, those minimum wages up. So is that the facts? Like, so again, I don't know all the information, but were those two companies forced to give a higher minimum wage, or were they doing it already before they were pushed?
Good question, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I don't know if it was before or after.
Sorry, I found my...
You found your statement?
I found my statistic here. We got a little disconnected in that first paragraph because it was among the 3.6 millions that are earning that wage, just over from 16 to 24.
Gotcha.
And in here, younger workers are disproportionately represented among people with low rates of pay in countries around the world. Only about 3% of American workers over the age of 24 earn the minimum wage.
3%?
3%.
Oh, shit. I thought it was way higher than that.
So did I. And until I read Thomas Sowell. It's pretty interesting at that point.
Yeah.
Like, how do we create a national discussion for adults at this point for that 3%? You know, what's causing that 3% at that point? Because that's to me, and you'd probably agree with this, what's the problem that's creating that in terms of how can we help those people be educated and more productive members of society?
I mean, I'm always an advocate for this public education and public housing. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can fix those two problems from the ground up, like, we're going to fix this country.
That'd be a good episode we need to do at some point, too, is public education.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
So 97% of the people...
97% of people over 24 make more than minimum wage.
97% of the people who work minimum wage...
No. 97% of people over 24 make more than minimum wage.
Gotcha.
Yep.
Percent or above 24 make above. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means that, but of the people who make minimum wage, 50% of them or 52% of them are between the ages of 16 and 24, and the rest are people older than 24. Those are the ones who work minimum wage.
Among 3.6 million Americans earning no more than minimum wage in 2012, just over half were from 16 to 24.
Yeah.
And 64% of them worked part-time.
And that's just talking about minimum wage. People who make $10.25 an hour are that percentage is. Mm-hmm. And people who make more than $7.25 an hour.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. On the same page now. Cool. Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, to your point, it's a lack of education that we're given. Like these, there's that old adage about, you know, I'm not even going to say it, but it.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, you probably can figure it out. A lot of facts tend to be obfuscated by politicians looking to gain political power, and it is deleterious to our society.
But again, I go back to what I mentioned earlier, right? I mean, a lot of these numbers, like numbers are numbers, mm-hmm. right? And I'm going to take this for facts because this guy's an economist and I know he knows his shit.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the savings that we make based on people and about numbers and about their livelihoods,
mm-hmm.
like there's an emotional aspect to it.
Yes.
And I think all of these clickbait titles and clickbait reports and clickbait commentary
mm-hmm.
is what's driving these emotional, you know, drivers.
Yeah.
And they move past the actual numbers. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Right. Well, because I want to help those people too that aren't making a big living. However, the evidence tends to suggest that paying a higher minimum wage is not the way to do that, and actually it produces a more negative effect. So in essence, we should not be pursuing that because it hurts them more than it helps them.
But I mean, I would feel like there is some type of, what am I trying to say here? There is a benefit of having some type. So I know you mentioned earlier, like the moral, like the, you state president, right? And then mm-hmm. that's going to drive the government to be able to do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is some type of necessity to be able to have some type of rules around labor.
Why do you think that?
I mean, like back in the 20s, we were just exploiting kids. Or, is it the 1820s? But anyways, back in the day, we used to exploit kids. Then mm-hmm. there was a rule about child labor.
Mm-hmm.
Then we used to, industrial jobs, there are certain, you know, issues. Mm-hmm. Then the government came in and put certain laws against those things. So again, I'm not, you know, fully equipped with the laws that were back in the place.
Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine that all of those things have been beneficial to where we have the living conditions, the labor conditions we have today. Does that kind of make sense?
It does. It seems,
and I guess it's different from the minimum wage right, conversation.
Well, yeah, and I'm not as familiar with that information in general, so I can't super comment on it. However, I can make a question here, and I have a question. How do we know that it was beneficial if we don't know what the other outcome would have been had the government not stepped in?
More dead kids?
Potentially, or it could have, you know, if free market industrialization could have led to having less child labor because it maybe was not as effective. Like that's what like slavery was not an economic positive for its existence. It was actually detrimental to the overall economy. And outside of the moral atrocity of enslaving another human being, it's also not economically effective. In that same vein, it seems that it would have the same effect with hiring children. Children are not going to be as productive or as intelligent as their mature counterparts in the workforce.
Yeah, but those kids are never going to be able to grow up to earn more than the minimum wage back then if they were just forced to work labor jobs and, you know, lose a limb or lose whatever the case is. And again, I don't know what the percentages are,
mm-hmm.
you know, based on these comments are a little bit more clickbaity, right?
Because mm-hmm.
I don't know all the information.
Right.
It's not like a gotcha, like, hey, what about this? But mm-hmm. it's more about, to me, it makes sense to have some type of rules that we can all agree to. I know it's unfortunate that it's a government, but
mm-hmm.
Maybe there is a way, but usually there is no private way of being able to establish rules for all of us to adopt, right? I mean, there's social norms.
Well, there's anarcho-capitalism, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I'm sure someday. We'll talk about that one day.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, like we have a government in place that we all voted for back in the day. We established this country,
mm-hmm.
and I think there's benefit of being able to have certain parameters and being able to move in certain direction. And so maybe the minimum wage isn't one of them,
mm-hmm.
but I would imagine that there is some type of benefit of having these type of rules come into place to where we can all agree on. I'm going on a tangent here for a minute,
but you're good.
I just think it's important to like having no minimum wage to me. And again, this is more of a my perspective. I don't know what the numbers state,
mm-hmm.
but if we were to say, you know what, the minimum wage is $0.
Minimum wage is always $0.
Well, I know it's always $0, but if the minimum wage were to be $0 from a government perspective,
mm-hmm.
like what would that mean? And to me, like, you're usually going to get more people. You're usually going to get more people being taken advantage of. Does that make sense?
What I'm trying to say is. Well, how do you know? How do you know? Again, I don't know that.
Mm-hmm. This is more of a feeling, right?
Right.
Based on the people that we know exist in this world.
Mm-hmm. So, if you feel that there needs to be some kind of a minimum wage, how do you know that not having the minimum wage would, or how do you know that not having the minimum wage would lead to exploitation is where I get to. How do you know that it doesn't open up more opportunities for people to switch between and choose jobs more easily because there's so much opportunity now? There's less steel requirements. You know that joke about for starting an entry-level job that you need to have 2 years of experience? Yeah. Well, if there's no minimum wage, it becomes easier to hire people to do those skill developing roles.
What if those people never gain any other skills? They're just stuck.
Well, the biggest obstacle to that would be having a minimum wage where their productivity is not worth the minimum wage, and so their wage is now zero. So they're not given the opportunity.
It's hard, right? I mean, even me earlier, like I was saying, you know what, we need to remove emotions. Mm-hmm. But like, it's hard for me to think about the farm workers, but hard for me to think about the janitors, hard for me to think about all these people who are not going to develop a higher skill set that's going to allow them to be able to make more money one day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some people are going to just get stuck, and it is what it is. And I know it's 3% of the population,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, that's still a pretty big number.
There's still people, yes. And there are people, like, there are brothers and sisters in humanity.
Yeah.
It's tough. So, why do you think that?
But back to your original question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, going up makes economic sense because.
What do you mean by going up?
Going up meaning if we have more minimum wage, if we have to pay more people, more money.
Mm-hmm.
That will, to me, it makes sense that inflation will just, it's like the phrase, rising tide raises all ships.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the rising tide is the minimum wage. And so that's an increase, increase inflation, increase the cost of home, increase the cost of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, it's like a net positive or a net, it's a wash. Because, I mean, you tried helping people by giving them more money,
mm-hmm.
but all it did was just raise everything else. So they end up having the same lifestyle. So sure. It's kind of the same shit.
Yeah. Travis passed me a note here. He said, not minimum wage, but... So what is it? I don't.
Here. Oh yeah, they're like the thing that's just interesting right now in our current times is, at least especially in the DFW area, and I think it's I've seen it elsewhere in the country. But there's lots of people or bosses looking to hire people for their business, and they're struggling finding people to actually come in and take the job because a lot of people are still, or many people are still living off of the government checks that are getting sent to them. And it's like, okay, what incentive do I have right now to actually go work? And that's more of like a UBI type discussion than actual minimum wage. But it's interesting seeing that. Like, I saw a restaurant over in California looking to hire for chefs and cooks, and they were looking for a $200 signing bonus and paying $20 to $25 an hour and willing to hire immediately. And there's a lot of those out there, but they're struggling to find people to go and fulfill those jobs. And a lot of that's driven by a lot of the stimulus that our government sent out.
I know we're going to talk about this in depth in the future about, you know, government programs, because it's a similar thing, right? Mm. Back in the '50s or whatever we talked about, or we're going to talk about that. But yeah, I mean, that sucks.
Yeah. And I don't really have a good answer. It's just it's an interesting data point that's going on right before our eyes right now.
Well, it's almost like a dichotomy, right? Because earlier we said, at least I still believe this, that people want to have fulfilling jobs that give them purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, if you give people the chance to be lazy and still be taken care of, they're going to choose the lazy route. And that's the part that's difficult, right? Because you want to help the people who want to help. But at the same time, when you help that 3% of the people who I want to help,
mm-hmm.
I'm also enabling the other X percentage just live a life of just cruising by. And those are people who don't need the help.
Well, and it's not just cruising by, but it's cruising by off of the backs of the people that are working and pursuing
meaning. Which is bullshit, right?
Yes.
And that's the hard part. That's why I think that, you know, these umbrella, and again, it's tough because I know the minimum wage thing, there's just so many more facets to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just based on the information that I have, like, I don't know if that's going to fix the problem. But it just goes back to, you know, those people that I want to help, there's other ways of helping them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if minimum wage is the only way to helping them.
Yeah. To it seems that having a government oversight into that is where there's an issue. It seems that we would be better served if we just took on the responsibility of helping those in our immediate community.
But who's that? Like, who's that person?
You are. You look at how many people you've helped with shit.
Yeah.
And you're going to think about the ripple effect of that and those people that can help their communities. It's an individual responsibility, and it's the responsibility of like us in this room to help those, because we see the need to develop that culture where we're going to work hard. We're going to help others where we can.
But do you ever feel like it's not enough?
I mean, it will never be enough.
Sure. That's the problem. I mean, it's not that's the problem, but that's the part that makes me feel like I need more help.
Mm.
And to me, like, the only person, the only entity that has the most power is unfortunately the government. And so, like, how do I help the most people? By having government, federal policies that can help me in pushing those things forward. However, you start getting into such, you know, difficult waters or nasty waters here, because, you know, what if I have every great intention, but mm-hmm. that says the president to help anybody who has good intentions, and I say this in quotations,
mm-hmm.
to go and push certain agendas, and then we go south.
Right.
So it's almost like, you know, you want the best for people, and you feel like the government is the best entity to do that. But at the same time, what if we go too far one way,
mm-hmm.
and the government just takes over everybody, and then like you're told that you have to live a certain way, and that's not the America that we want to live in.
Right. I do not like the government being the arbitrator of our God-given rights. The government does not grant us our rights. Yeah. They are God-given, and the government should be there to protect them. When the government tells us how to live, that is an infringement on our rights.
Yeah.
And
it's, mm-hmm. it's true, right? It just, people who don't, like, when you feel like you have your hands tied, and I don't feel like I have my hands tied. Like, I don't have a victim complex, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been able to get past all that.
Yep.
And I feel like there's things that I have power in my life to be able to make to your point, a ripple effect and really make a difference in like my community and the lives that I want to impact.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who don't have that education and exposure, to them, it's just like, well, what's the easiest thing I can do? I'm going to just, you know, get together and I'm going to go tell the government to help me out and I'm going to make the most impact. And it's not that it's a lazy route to take, but it kind of boils down to being the lazy route to take, because you just tell other people to solve your problems.
Mm-hmm.
And to you, it feels like you're going to help the most people. But a lot of people, they lack the strategic thinking,
mm-hmm.
and they're not able to say, okay, if I do this, what's the cause and effect?
Right, what are the consequences of my actions?
And a lot of people just, they don't know how to think about, and again, I'm just generalizing here, but sometimes the interactions that I've had with individuals, they don't know how to think 10, 20 years down the road.
Right.
And that's, to me, is scary,
because mm-hmm.
you're telling somebody else like, hey, I think this is going to fix things, go and implement it. And then once shit goes south, you can fix it.
Yeah. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because there's a great passage in here I want to read specifically about how minimum wage has affected the Black population, which is very interesting. Let me find the perfect starting spot. Here we go. Another group disproportionately affected by minimum wage laws are members of unpopular racial or ethnic minority groups. Indeed, minimum wage laws were once advocated explicitly because of the likelihood that such laws would reduce or eliminate the competition of particular minorities, whether they were Japanese in Canada during the 1920s or Blacks in the United States and South Africa during the same era. Such expressions of overt racial discrimination were both legal and socially accepted in all three countries at that time. The history of Black workers in the United States illustrates this point. As already noted, from the late 19th century on through the middle of the 20th century, the labor force participation rate of Black Americans was slightly higher than that of white Americans. In other words, Blacks were just as employable at the wages they received as whites were at their very different wages. The minimum wage law changed that. Before federal minimum wage laws were instituted in the 1930s, the Black unemployment rate was slightly lower than the white unemployment rate in 1930. But then followed the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931, the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, and Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, all of which were imposed government-mandated minimum wages, either on a particular sector or more broadly. The National Labor Relations Act of 1935, which promoted unionization, also tended to price black workers out of jobs, in addition to union rules that kept blacks from jobs by barring them from union membership. The National Industrial Recovery Act raised wage rates in southern textile industry by 70% in just 5 months, and its impact nationwide was estimated to cost blacks half a million jobs. While this act was later declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, establishing a national minimum wage, was upheld by the High Court. As already noted, the inflation of the 40s was largely nullified the effect of the Fair Labor Standards Act until it was amended in 1950 to raise minimum wages to a level that would have some actual effect on current wages. The unemployment rates of young black males during the late 1940s, the years prior to repeated escalations of the minimum wage that began in 1950, contrast sharply with their unemployment rates in later years. As of 1948, for example, the unemployment rate for blacks aged 16 to 17 years was 9.4%, while that of whites the same ages was 10.2%. For blacks of 18 to 19 years of age, the unemployment rate in that year was 10.5%, while that of whites was of the same ages was 9.4%. In short, teenage unemployment rates were a fraction of what they were to become in later years, and black and white teenage unemployment rates were very similar. Even the following year, 1949, was a recession year. Rising black teenage male unemployment rates that year still did not reach 20%. The black teenage unemployment rates during the recession of 1949 was lower than it was to be at any time during even the boom years of the 1960s and later decades. Black 16 and 17-year-olds had an unemployment rate of 15.8% in the 1949 recession year, but that was less than half of what it would be in every year from 1971 through 1997, and less than one-third of what it would be in 2009. Repeated increases in the minimum wage marked these later years of much higher unemployment rates among black teenagers. The wide gap between unemployment rates of black and white teenage males likewise dates from the escalation of the minimum wage and the spread of its coverage in the 1950s. The usual explanations of higher unemployment among black teenagers, less education, lack of skills, racism, cannot explain their rising unemployment, since all these handicaps were worse during the earlier period when black teenage unemployment was much lower. That passage, when I first read it, was really, it took me a minute to process that, because that countered every single notion I had about what I understood the reality of minimum wage, and especially how it affected the black community. And that was a pill to swallow for sure. What do you think about that?
And I'm still wrapping my head around it.
Yeah. And I'll share this. I'll give Fernando the text link to this particular essay that Thomas Sowell wrote, and so we can share it, and so y'all can read it and tell me I'm an idiot for how I read it.
So I guess it breaks down to when the Fair Labor Standards Act came in 1938, mm-hmm. It made things worse.
Yes.
So that's
and it's continued to make things worse. The black unemployment rate was a third of what it is now for those teenagers.
Does it say anything else about like what could have contributed to that?
Well, it I'll let you reread it at some point. I believe it talks about it in
there. Later on, does it say anything else?
It does, but ultimately it's there weren't enough other factors that could make that seemed to indicate a big contributor to that fact of the rising unemployment rates.
Yeah. There's what's the name of the book that I'm thinking about? It's a housing book that I want you to read too. Oh my God. Anyways, a lot of these issues, because I mean, a lot of these percentages were in the 40s, 50s, mm-hmm. right? And that's when a lot of the housing, the negative housing protocols that were put into the government with the assistance programs and all that kind of thing, mm-hmm. that also made a big impact in the black and Hispanic community, mainly in the black community. I mean, most of this information that we had back in the day, the statistics that we were able to gather are mm-hmm. either black or white.
Right.
But in the 40s and 50s, the housing stuff was a really big impact for the unemployment rate for black Americans.
How so?
And again, it's been a while since I read the book.
Yeah.
But it caused a lot of mobilization for people who were able to work in certain areas that were displaced. And then that caused them not to be able to live in certain areas to to be able to work. And so a lot of the people that were displaced because of, you know, eminent domain or because of zoning laws or because of, you know, whatever the case is, you know, there's all these different things that caused people to move. And so because they were not close to their work or because they had to travel and there wasn't any certain means of, for them to get to work, that caused them just to like not be able to work. So that, that increased unemployment rates.
Yes.
And again, I'm paraphrasing here.
Yeah. And I actually want to jump on that because I know a little bit about New York's public housing because I read that the 1,000-page biography on Robert Moses, one of the most powerful officials of all time. For those of you who don't know Robert Moses, I highly recommend you check him out. Read the book, The Power Broker by Robert Caro. So Robert Moses held at one point 15 federal and state positions and built every highway, freeway, expressway, the Battery Tunnel Bridge, 500-plus parks in New York in his time span there. And he was a very notable racist towards Hispanics and blacks. And he deliberately targeted their communities for redevelopment and instituted it with such intentional ambiguity as to how the system worked for them to be relocated that most of these groups were never able to be relocated once they were kicked out from eminent domain for him to build his highways, which is fucked.
Yeah.
Yep. And again, that's where I'm always cognizant of the dangers of political power, specifically like that's a perfect example of one man, his vision, whether it be moral or not, he gets the power to implement his ideas. And that's where I'm like, because those were not elected positions. He just wrote them into.
Right. Yeah. And that's the scary thing, right? Because I think we go back to, you know, things that we both said earlier is if you start giving the government isn't a person, the government is an entity. And the entity is made up of good people and bad people and so-so people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start giving this entity power to do whatever the fuck they want, you realistically start getting more bad people going into those positions,
right?
And having more power.
And does it seem likely that they would ever give that power back?
No, they wouldn't, right? And that's the problem, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you have limited power for the government, to me, and again, I'm just coming up with this shit on the spot, but if you have limited power for the government, you're usually going to try to get more good people because more good people are willing to give up their opportunity to do more good, greater good in the private sector. And so they're going to go and help from a government perspective, right? Because they want to do more good. But if you have limited power, those powerful people who just want to do bad in the world, they're going to stay on the private side and try to, you know, manipulate other people to do their stuff.
I would actually argue the opposite.
Would you?
I would say that the most corrupt people in government are those career politicians who seek to be in government and acquire the power of the associations through government and then move into the private sector.
If you were to put a percentage of the people who you think, and again, there's a lot of numbers, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people involved. But do you think it's half of the people, politicians are just corrupt individuals?
I'd say more.
More than half?
Yeah, I'd say the large majority. I'll do a quick research at some point to see how many politicians have been in office for longer than 10 years. To me, that seems the maximum amount of time anybody should be allowed to serve in a government role.
I mean, part of this, I'm just talking out of my ass because I'm just...
No, I love it. I like hearing you think off the cuff because these are great questions. These are great things to think about. Oh, Travis.
Well, and like I'll just... like you can peek in behind the veil of corruption. Like you look at, for example, our current Secretary of Defense. He was with Raytheon, and now he's our Secretary of Defense.
Those company names.
And then we all of a sudden got all these government contracts awarded to Raytheon. Granted, they tend to get large government contracts. But then you also look at politicians, and if you're able to dig in and see their financial statements, because they have to disclose those, and you see what companies they're investing in, that's really how I would argue that the most of our politicians gather vast wealth is really through kind of back end insider trading. They invest in these companies, pass legislation, and they grow.
Yeah, for another perfect example from a Robert Caro book, look at how LBJ became a millionaire during his time in office by manipulating the
infrastructure, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was through the radio. I forget exactly, but he basically stole the best airwave for his radio station where he could advertise for companies that donated to his campaign, in essence. So he used it as I have the most popular radio station that I stole from another group because of my political connections, and I'm using it as a funnel for these companies to donate more to my political endeavors because I have the best advertising space. And so it was basically a laundering thing.
I mean, there's a lot going of that going on in the world.
Yeah.
Which sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just to kind of bring us back and kind of to closing on the minimum wage stuff, like the numbers speak for themselves, I guess. And the numbers dictate that, you know, yes, in theory, it would be a good thing to increase the minimum wage to be able to help, you know, more people. It feels that way to be able to, because I think if you increase the minimum wage, there's also debates about as you increase that, you increase the wages of teachers, the wages of janitors, the wages of a bunch of other people. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it wouldn't make sense for somebody who works at McDonald's to make more money than a teacher.
Right.
Again, that's a whole completely different conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, like, you know, talking about teachers as minimum wage employees, like, that's bullshit. Like, they should get paid more money.
Teachers should be paid based on merit.
Sure, and resources, but we'll get into that later because yep. I feel like there's so many other topics that I want to talk about.
Yeah.
On that.
So
I'll make that note. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to say, for my kind of closing statement, we agree on like everything. Yeah. We want to help the most people, and for our listeners, it seems the best way for us to help those folks that are disenfranchised in whatever regard that may be, is taking on the individual responsibility of helping those in your immediate community. Like, that to me is what it means to be a good person, is helping those who you see personally that can benefit from your help in doing so.
Yeah. I just urge people that, you know, if you're advocating for the minimum wage increase to help a certain number of people, like, find ways to help those individuals regardless of minimum wage or not.
Right. And if we are advocating for legislation, we always have to think of that consequence down the road, that yeah. what happens later and what happens down the road. Yeah. What's the future consequence and what's the cost of this idea?
Because it's just simple to, you know, put a broad stroke on something and say, oh, it's all fixed now. And mm-hmm. it's like, no, not really.
Right. Right.
Cool. All right. Well, good topic. We'll talk to you all later. Hope everybody's enjoying their life, I guess. There's no more summer. There's no more. We're going into the summer.
Hope you're enjoying your sleeping.
Post COVID, maybe.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
can we say that yet?
We're in Texas, so we can say it. Yeah. sorry, non-Texas listeners and non-Florida listeners.
We all take care and talk to y'all later.
Yep. Talk to you soon.